Welcome to Ivy the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello and welcome. On this episode of Ivy the Future, we're featuring a clip from the recent Signature in the Cell event in Tampa, Florida, featuring Dr. Tom Woodward, Dr. David Berlinski, Dr. Stephen Meyer, and Michael Medved. Listen in as Dr. Meyer interviews Dr. Berlinski about the questions that led him to criticize Darwin.
Here to give us more clues is Dr. David Berlinski. Thank you.
I'm not Dr. Berlinski. I'm Steve Meyer. But I'm going to interview him for two reasons. One, we thought it'd be fun to vary the pace a bit. Three reasons, actually. Secondly, I secretly wish I were Michael Medved. And thirdly, David has a bit of a shoulder injury, and so we're going to allow him to sit down. And, of course, his slouch is now world famous because of Expelled. So we thought we'd put him in the most comfortable and flattering light. David, I'm going to just ask some questions from
sure.
up here, and we'll get her going. You're not principally known as an advocate of intelligent design. You've been very friendly to those of us who are, but you are principally known for the hard and penetrating questions you've been asking about many theories in mainstream science, and particularly Darwin's theory of evolution.
Sure.
And in 1996, you wrote a very interesting essay that got a lot of attention in the intellectual magazine commentary, and that the essay was called "The Deniable Darwin." Your new book is a collection of essays has that as its title. And I just wondered if you could, first of all, tell us how you became skeptical about Darwinism, a little bit of your own history with the issue, and then some of the reasons for your skepticism, which you outlined in that now very, very either famous or notorious essay.
Both,
yeah.
Both. Sure. Actually, my interest in this question is really of long standing. In the early part of the 1970s, I was playing around with certain ideas, and I just happened to interview Noam Chomsky, the linguist. And we were talking about evolution. At that time, in the early 1970s, Chomsky was very willing to be indignant, almost florid about Darwinism. And he said, the man you really have to see is Marco Schutzenberger in Paris. And Schutzenberger and Chomsky had done a lot of important work in mathematical linguistics together. And Chomsky arranged it, and I went over to Paris. And I sat down with Marco, and we became very close friends. And that was really the beginning of my interest in this question, because Marco Schutzenberger, in addition to being a great mathematician and very penetrating intelligence, was profoundly skeptical about biology. And he had been a professional biologist, worked in the glorious moment of French intellectual history when people like Jacques Monod had revolutionized our understanding of molecular biology. And he was also, in addition to being a world-famous mathematician, a world-famous physician. So he spoke with a considerable authority about these measures. And we fell into a close friendship, and we decided to explore these issues. And I published my first paper, Journal of Philosophy of all things, trying to ask the question whether certain mathematical models, these were drawn from automata theory, in any way shed some light on questions of change in biology. And this was a very juvenile paper. I don't suggest to you at all that it was a paper of significance, but for one thing, no matter which way Marco and I turned the facts or turned the theories or played with the ideas, it became very clear that there was a kind of threshold. Below the threshold were processes which could not really account for anything interesting. Just as in psychology, Skinner's behavioral psychology could not account for anything interesting in learning. And above that threshold, there was a tremendous amount of interesting work. That threshold was precisely the point in which an abstract model began to acquire the properties of a memory. And what occurred to me and what occurred to Marco and certainly other people was, in terms of Darwin's theory of evolution, there is no memory. There is no looking forward or preserving the past in terms of a real memory that can be used sporadically or continuously in order to develop the properties of an organism or a species. That's how I got into
it. So you're thinking about this almost in terms of memory as a concept in computer science.
That that's need, exactly.
Remember
right.
when I heard you lecture at Yale?
Yeah. In automata, 2000, more general.
You used this the memorable phrase. What you need for natural selection to work is something like forward-looking memory.
Yeah.
The ability to.
It's called a push-down storage.
Yeah.
And it has to be there, because if it's not there, you have a very primitive level of mechanism. And that's how I got interested, because kind of by the back door, it wasn't really addressing the biology, but trying to put together the right kind of model with the facts as I understood
them. And a lot of the early critics of Darwin, scientific critics, that first emerged in the 1960s surrounding that event at the Wistar Institute,
yeah.
were MIT physicists and mathematicians and computer
Murray
scientists.
Murray Eden, for example.
Yes, exactly. And why did so many mathematically inclined scientists begin to doubt the Darwinian mechanism? You unpack that a bit with your discussion of the combinatorial
combinatorial explosion. Well, I think it's important to realize that until about, I would say, 1950, 1960, the mathematicians had not really interested themselves in Darwin's theory of evolution. They're mathematicians, after all, tremendously arrogant and proud of their craft. Biology is a matter of dismal, wet plops. But the moment they began to interest themselves professionally, a very striking number of important mathematicians would say to one another, you know, there's something not right. I mean, mathematically, it's not right.
And was this a question of the odds of generating these?
It's a question of probability. The phrase that I used was combinatorial explosion. If you think of proteins, as Tom mentioned, and you talk about how many possible proteins there are of, say, 250 residues in length, the number is extraordinary, 20 to the 250th power.
You've got 20 possibilities at each site, times
exactly.
20, times 20,
exactly.
times 20. So there's.
So the natural question that Marco and I were asking, and Noam Chomsky was asking the same question, he has recanted since because of pressure in his academic world, was how did life ever find this very small target amidst this infernal sea of possibilities? And that's where the idea of combinatorial explosion.
So there's this, I love your image here. You've got a kind of a sea of possibilities.
Immense.
So 200.
In the paper,
20
in commentary,
times 20 times 20 times 20 times 20 to the 250th power, kind of a number.
Imagine you're on the planet Pluto.
Right.
And you have no idea where you're going. Huge, big, gaseous planet.
You mean Jupiter. Pluto's the little one.
Oh, well, one of the big ones, Jupiter. And you're trying to find a dime.
Yeah.
That's the problem life is facing. You want a dime's worth of integrity, and it's in an incredible sea of possibilities.
And the mechanism of natural selection and acting on random mutations, though, is essentially blind and undirected.
It has to be.
A blind man looking
it
for
has
that
to
dime.
Be. Yeah. It has to be. And I was at the same time, and Marco and I were both very, very suspicious of this Dawkins notion of cumulative selection. It never made the slightest bit of sense to me, because the odds don't diminish in cumulative selection as long as a single constraint is in place, that changes have to be sequential. They have to come one after the other in the right order. And that's a devastating limitation on Darwinian mm-hmm. selection. But I have to say, every mathematician that I've known, John Colarota, Marco Schutzenberger, René Thom, Lippmann Burrs, as soon as the discussion turned to Darwin's theory of evolution, because they were very sophisticated, they recognized the political problems inherent in the discussion. But they all had the same reaction. You know, it's kind of nutty. It's kind of nutty. And that really is my view, too.
But these folks were all biblical fundamentalists, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. The last man.
Yeah, it reminds me, what you're saying about the mathematicians reminds me of a conversation I had with Fritz Schaefer,
who's been the chemist.
Five times nominated for the Nobel Prize. He's a 1,000 peer-reviewed articles, and his comment was, well, he said, everyone in my field knows that the standards of evidence are somewhat lower in evolutionary biology. You know,
why does it hurt to admit that?
Yeah.
I've never understood. The standards are lower, and the field is very different, and that shouldn't be a source of...
of shame or self-reproach. It's a young field. It's only 50 or 60 years old, really. And we're groping. That's the truth. We're really groping. We don't understand most of what we're discovering.
For more with Stephen Meyer, David Berlinski, Tom Woodward, and Michael Medved, go to www.signatureinthecell.com and visit the events page, where we have a link to listen to the event in its entirety. For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.